Hi, I'm Genevieve. I'm an alcoholic. How's the volume on this? It looked like there were problems before. Can you all hear me? Ah, great. You can hear me. Well, I took off my shoes so I could be a little lower down to the mic, actually, is the real thing. Okay. Hi. I'm DCM for 13E. My home group is High Noon Group in Virginia Highland of Atlanta. Come see us. If you're down, we meet 6 days a week at noon, and then just because we're alcoholics, at 1 p.m. on Saturday. So we're a group called High Noon that meets at 1 on Saturday. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. She consults with her sponsor, which I could try to consult with her, which tries to, I think, keeps us sane. I sponsor women, and I try to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just like to thank Rick for asking me to speak 9 weeks ago so that I could really sweat periodically for 9 weeks. Thanks so much, Rick. It's an honor. No, it is an honor. I've been in service for about general service for about 5 years. Started as a GSR in my home group, and here I am. And who knows? Better than where I came from. That's for sure. I was born and raised in New York City. Both my parents were in the book business. Alcohol was really a benevolent part of our household. It is all over my family, but my little family unit, it just got me and my sister. My parents were not alcoholics. My dad's side was just like shotgun shot through with it. We did a little tabulation, and my generation on my dad's side, 66% of us self-proclaimed alcoholics. We are all in the program except one of us. He knows he's an alcoholic. We are there for him. We have talked to him. He does not like AA. He does not think it will work for him. Nobody is pushing him, but we were all there for him. And the rest of us are buried deep, deep in AA. My mother, when I think about it, my mother had the obsession of the mind for sure. She needed alcohol every day, not physically, but mentally. She would wait for it. She would look forward to it. A certain time of night would come, she would need it. When she didn't have it, it was a big problem. She would send my father out in all circumstances to get her alcohol, but she stopped. She stopped every night. She had one of those wine savers, you know, that you like put it. Let me explain what a wine saver is to you guys. Because I grew up with one. I'm not saying I used one, but I grew up with one. It like takes the air out of the wine bottle so that you can enjoy it the next day or even the day after. And like, I know I see a lot of looks that I recognize, because you know when the best day to enjoy the wine is now, you know. And you don't need a wine saver when you finish the bottle. So that was my solution to the wine saver. But that was my mom. So she had the obsession, but she never developed the allergy. And that was confusing for me for a while, because I just thought I was like my mom. You know, like certain time of night came along, the shoulders went up. It was time for me. You know, it was time for mine. But I developed the allergy, so that didn't become, after a while, that became an unlivable situation. So alcohol had a very benign feel in my family. They were in the book business. There would be lots of dinner parties with dim lights and conversation, the adults in the other room murmuring, and they would start with cocktails and wine and after-dinner drinks, but no one ever threw a glass across the room or slept with the wrong person. I mean, everyone got home. You know, they were very civilized about it. And looking at my mom's story, I remember she sat me down once and talked about it, where she was a literary agent in New York City, and they used to have martini lunches. And she realized she got into these martini lunches pretty heavy, you know, and then she would go back to work. She'd wobble back to work and then, you know, and wait for the wine. And she realized she was not going to succeed if she kept drinking like that. And she made a decision, not the kind of decision we have to make. She was an atheist, but she made a decision to succeed professionally and stop those lunches. She started drinking seltzer. That was that. That was my mom. My mom lived a great long life. She was incredibly successful. She was not an alcoholic. I started drinking pretty young. I discovered the liquor cabinet. There was no lock on it. And it was down at my level, probably 7 years old. And I opened it up, and it looked like the Emerald City. You know, it was like the smell would hit you, and there was the green bottle and the blue bottle rising, you know. And I began trying the liquor, and clear the sinuses. And I started really early, you know, the secrets started really early. I started really young putting water back in those bottles. I wouldn't have been able to tell you why I was doing that. If my parents had caught me, I don't think there would have been huge consequences. They would have been just puzzled by why this little half pint was going through the liquor cabinet. I did not like it. I did not like the taste. I actually did not like the way it made me feel, but there was power there, and I knew there was, and I was drawn back to that power. There was no reason for me to be an unhappy little kid. I have wasted so much time on therapy couches trying to figure out why I feel like I did not fit or belong. A lot of money was spent, not covered by health insurance, trying to figure out why I felt like that. I look back at family photos now, and it's just this, it's a pretty happy family, and then there's this little dark cloud in the corner, and it was me. I mean, back from the littlest thing. I mean, this one when I was like 4 years old, I had raspberry jam all over my face. I mean, you'd think that would be like a cause for celebration, but instead I'm just with this little thundercloud face, and that was me. I just did not fit. I was sent into therapy at 7. About the same time I discovered the liquor cabinet, and we were all looking for solutions, you know. The therapist, the family legend is that I didn't say a single word for a year. I can't corroborate that because I can't really remember, but I do remember she had a bottle of sugar pills that she would put in her coffee, room full of toys. It's like a child therapist. I didn't want any of the toys. All I wanted was that sugar pill bottle. And I would take it and just shake it at her for a year. And finally she called my parents in and said, "This girl will not make it. You will need to send her away." And they didn't. They didn't send me away. And I did make it. Thanks to you. Thanks to you and thanks to God. I really started drinking hard in college, and it was alcohol really started to make decisions for me in college. Although I couldn't see that. I always thought I made my own decisions. I always thought I made my own way. My life was mine, you know. But it started to act very subtly in my life because I needed it already. I didn't need it physically yet. I could have a hard night or a hard two nights and detox just fine and wake up and, you know, chug some orange juice and eat a lot of bacon and get to class. I mean, I didn't need it. I didn't need to be detoxed yet, but I needed it mentally. I became psychologically dependent on it in college, no question about it. And when I look back, you know how our stories just kind of clear up? You get sober and the haze clears and the smoke kind of drifts away and you just start... Your story starts coming clear. Like, my God, that's why I did that. I didn't know I was being driven. I was being driven. I love that part in the Big Book. Driven. We are driven. I always think of that. And I'm not talking about, like, knee in the front seat. You know, maybe I get to see her a little bit. I'm talking, like, back seat. I have no control. I'm being driven by alcoholism from, I think, when I was in college. I had the chance to play. I went to this Northeast college, and there's this sport up there. Maybe you've heard of it. It's called lacrosse. Anyone hear of it? It's not really a Southern thing, I don't think. Yeah. So, but it had, in my college, it had a lot of prestige to it. So I had the chance to play it. Like, it had the kind of prestige where they wash your clothes for you. Like, you practice, and then you take off your dirties, and they give you this big pin, and you put your clothes on it, and then you come back the next day, there's magically clean clothes. Right, it's like that kind of prestige. Like, you got to wear the jacket. People knew. I played for a season, and they did not drink like I did. And I could not play anymore. I would go to parties, and they would want to like play games at the parties, you know, and like they only drank beer, and so I'm, you know, I get a couple beers in me, and I'm like, where's the tough stuff? Like, we're the adults in this room, and they just, you know, they wanted to be fit and great at their sport, and they were all talking about their boyfriends, and I'm just like, where's the drinks? You know, so I quit and I joined the rugby team. Which seemed like, you know, a great fit, and I had a lot of fun. But looking back, I realized, and that seems, who cares, right? You switch sports, big deal. You're not in jail. But when I look back at it, I realized that was not my decision. That was not really my decision. We drank like. Like that was the sport. We would start. We play our games on Saturday, so we'd start on Thursday nights, hard drinking. We would drink Friday, hard drinking in the woods. We would drink after the game with the other team. We would drink that night, you know, and then we would usually take a few days off. That was where I think the real love affair began for me and alcohol, where the. I just started to feel, you know, I had arrived. Bill's language is, in some way, that I read Bill's story and I'm like, I'm not like this man at all, this stock speculator from, and then he has a line and I'm just like, yeah, okay, you know, I'm exactly like Bill Wilson. I had arrived, you know, I love when he says that. We would drink around campfires and I would just feel this, just a sense of warmth and belonging that I just always wanted that so bad. I always felt on the outside. There was no reason for me to. I did not suffer abuse as a child. I had a loving family. I had advantages. It's an inside thing. You cannot. I didn't have the words to tell them that what was cut out. I felt like I just had a cut out here. That was just gouged out. And when I drank, it just got so warm in there, and I felt free. My spirit was enlivened, and I came to life. And so that's where the love affair started in college for me. And it was just fine. It was a safe environment to get plastered, and I surrounded myself with hard drinkers. I didn't look any different from anybody else. There was a guy on the men's team who had to go into AA in college, and he was the kind of guy who wet his pants in front of everybody, you know? And I was like, now there's an alcoholic. Yeah. I was talking to my friend about wetting pants, and we were driving along, we were sober, you know, we were in the program, and I was like, I never wet my pants, and then I was like, actually, I mean, not like all the way down the legs, but like, so. I never said my sobriety date. It's December the 8th, 2012. So as this journey unfolds, I'm sure that more humiliations will like rise to the surface for me about things I did, and because that's what we do for each other. We tell each other our stories, and the fog clears, and I think, oh my God, I did that too. But it's such a safe environment to realize that. It's not like I'm in some group of good-looking, normal folk who, you know, and then I suddenly realized that I did piss my pants, you know, and like, and I have to really keep that down, you know, like, I can't come out for polite conversation, but with you guys, I can say it, and I mean, how many people have pissed their pants a little bit? Like, okay. Right, we're there, and if you didn't, it's fine. You know, it doesn't mean you're not an alcoholic. It's fine. It's okay. All right, I'm gonna piss your pants. But anyway, the alcoholism in my family is a kind of like kudzu variety, like creeping alcohol. We're not the brawlers. We're the kind of get home and quietly fight with our bottle people in our living room alcoholics, and we can go on for years. It's that the brawlers are always, I'm always sort of like, I have this friend who's like, and then she pushed my face into the pavement, and then the cops, and it's like her story is just so, there's like sirens all over her story, and that's just, it's just not the story of the alcoholics in my family. We really did get home. We really worked at getting home into our own beds. There wasn't a lot of like waking up with someone I don't know. Like that didn't happen, but the battle was so private and intense and crippling in my own home. Just with me and the bottle and the little path between me and the fridge and me and the couch and me and the fridge and me and the couch and the deliberations that was, and our family can go, my uncle didn't die of this until he was almost 80, and we can just go a long, long time. And I think the brawlers and those of you who have really tough stories like that, you know, there are cliffs all over those stories. You just can fall off. And there are cliffs in mine, too. I did my share of drunk driving. I was just like, I never got caught. I never got a DUI, but I was just arguing with a friend of mine that since I had done it, like, on super highways and construction, that, like, I deserve 5 DUIs. And, like, if hers were only on side streets and, like, small roads, that didn't count. And that, like, and in fact, my greatest drunk driving was on the D.C. Beltway. So, like, I really do deserve a lot of DUIs, but it's just such a, the disease is so insidious because I think it's so loud and brash in some of us and so quiet and creeping, but it is a killer either way. So I didn't really cross the line. I had some good period of control until my 30s, really. I could step away from it. I could do little drying out periods. I could get back on my feet. I could put the plug in the jug. I could say, you know, I'm tired tonight. I've got something big tomorrow. I really had some nice control until somewhere in my 30s. I don't know where I got pickled, but I am pickled. Something happened, and I'm not that interested in the science. I think some people out there know a lot about the science, about what happens to us when we put it in metabolically or something is released, and I don't really need to know. I can honestly say that if there was a pill or something I could take that would change that reaction in my body and that when I drank I could just easily have one or two, I can honestly say I would not take it because I would lose this. And I was, even though I wasn't pickled until my 30s, I knew that there was something really, really wrong inside. And I went on an intense hunt for the answer in my 20s. I was a real spiritual lily pad hopper. I mean, I had a bookshelf, like the self-help heaven bookshelf. I think I passed out with the Course in Miracles on my face once. So I don't know if y'all know what the Course in Miracles is, but it's about this big, and you should not, like, drink and try to read it. Lying down with it above your head. There were some real silly pursuits in there, trying to fill this hole, trying to get right with myself. I know what that hunt was for now, but I was not ready to say that. And like I said, my mom was an atheist. We grew up... my parents fled the South. The religion they grew up with didn't work for them, so they let us be, me and my sister. But we did have a religion. We worshipped the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost of our family was the New York Times, PBS, and NPR. No doubt about that. We worshipped achievement. We worshipped what your teacher said about you. We worshipped grades. They didn't worship money. But money was important. We had our religion, for sure, that even though we called ourselves atheists and agnostics. But some of my spiritual pursuits were silly, but others saved my life. They saved my life. I went deep into Zen Buddhism for many years in my 20s. Just trying to, you know, I already knew this was a problem. I already knew this was a beehive. And this was so unkind in here. hateful thoughts about other people, hateful thoughts about myself. No quiet, no peace, except when I drank. Then quiet, peace, belonging. Zen was incredible. Teaching me how to meditate. I'd go on long retreats. I had short hair. We had to sew our clothes. I got a funny name. I had a Roshi. It was really powerful, but it could not stop the alcoholism. And all the years where I meditated and put on the black robe and bowed and did atonement ceremonies and incense, the alcoholism was progressing. I would get off of a week-long retreat where you'd get up at 5 a.m., you'd sit for 9 hours, you'd go to bed. A week of that, and you get pretty high. I gotta tell you, you feel amazing. And the retreat would end, and we would all be in our black robes in the cafeteria, and I'm looking for who has the alcohol. Because it's always, there's that wonderful line in the 12 and 12, we're always looking to extend the high or make the high higher. It's got to be better than this. What's next? What's more? There's just never enough. So, but what the Zen gave me was, it helped me begin to see what was happening in here. So, we just get lied to by the disease. It's such a killer. Just the delusions. When you sit down with somebody and you're trying to offer the hand of AA, maybe they want it. They start talking about it. You're already seeing their fourth step being written in front of you, but you don't want to tell them that was column two, and when are you going to get to column three? Because they're not in the program yet. That's me. That's what the mind. I know alcoholism, just like the book says, the problem's in the mind. If I drink, body kicks in. Want more. No question. The way to solve the allergy of the body, just don't drink. I get it. Cannot take that first drink. But it's the mind that's going to kill me. So Zen was so helpful with that. Sit and watch. Sit and watch. Sit and watch. But it just could not save me from the alcoholism. And I remember the day my Roshi talked about her Roshi, who was one of the guys who came over from Japan in the 60s and started spreading this around the United States. He died from an alcohol-related death. He got drunk and died in a hot tub. And when I heard that, something struck inside me. There was no way I was going to meditate as much as this man from Japan came over, who was a Roshi, and he died in a hot tub. So I kind of drifted away from Zen, and the alcoholism really kicked into high gear. I lost a long-term relationship with a non-drinker that had kind of kept me in check in a lot of ways. I started one with a hard drinker, and we were just off. I just went over a cliff. Those Ansel Adams paintings of the gentle slope of the rock dome, and then suddenly it's like, it goes straight down. That's what I felt, how I felt happened. There was never a moment when we didn't have. I stopped drinking. Everything but tequila. it sounds really funny now, but the experience of trying to drink other things was so frustrating. It was too sweet, I couldn't get enough down. It was too bubbly, I couldn't swallow it fast enough. It was too weak, it wasn't giving me the power that I needed. The only thing that worked in the end was tequila, and the way I justified that to myself is that it was low glycemic. So that even when I started to drink it without ice, eventually from the bottle, it was because I was being paleo. So that's what. That's what happened. So me and this person really kicked it up and drank like that and drank tequila and got ourselves into dangerous. Those were my most dangerous situations. Then we got into a speedboat accident. We're probably going about 80 miles an hour drunk, and I watched a girl next to me fly up over me, and her head was coming down on the side of the boat, but it hit my arm instead. So my arm maybe saved her life. And we went home and drank some more. That's just that's just the alcoholic life. I mean, that's the alcoholic insanity. I started to do demoralizing things that I didn't think my standards about myself had to drop quickly, like an elevator, to be able to live with myself. Like, again, they were behind closed doors. They weren't in public. They weren't at bars. So there was not a public record of what happened. But I became unrecognizable to myself. And there's this wonderful quote in the 24-hour book. I don't know what date it is, but it talks about how even before I know God is there, even before I've asked for help, God knows I'm falling and will reach for me. And that began to happen. I wasn't ready to say the word God. I wasn't ready to admit a need for God or even for help. But moments of grace began to open in my life. One night I was curled in bed. I was drunk. I was afraid. I knew I was out of control. And a little voice said, if this gets too bad, there's always AA. And I didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know any of my cousins were there. We didn't talk about it. But that stuck. And I relaxed and I slept. Another time, a night which I really consider my bottom, you know, God was right there. It was a perfect alcoholic day. I know you guys know these days. You wake up, I woke up and I said, not today. I said it to myself. I meant it. I was frightened. I knew I was out of control. I had no job at that point. I was living off of my parents. My friends had started to jump ship. I had a 20-year friend come and say, we are done with this friendship. I don't want to see you again. My life was one drama after another, and I could not stop drinking. I could not control my drinking. I needed to drink. I didn't want to. I needed to. It was not working anymore. I would drink and I would be filled with terror. I would drink and I would hate myself. I did not want to drink that day. 5 o'clock came. I was with somebody else. I said, do not let me drink. I was trying to recruit people. I turned to her and said, can you make me a drink? And it came out of my mouth and I just heard it. I just heard the insanity, and she made me a drink, and I ended up drinking, and she went to another room, and I drank harder because I knew I couldn't drink like I wanted to around her. I reached for the bottle of tequila to drink from it, and the thought came, this is an alcoholic. And that's the thought that got me into AA. Didn't get sober that night, but it was soon. It was soon after that. I woke up one morning. You know, they say it's like your standards have to drop. Like, the person I was and who I wanted to be, the rift was too great now between them. The cognitive dissonance between those two things was too great to live with for me anymore. When I was sober, I looked at reality of who I was and who I really hoped I would be. It was too great, and the drinking wasn't taking that away. So the only thing left was suicide. So I'd begun to consider that. Instead, I thought I will take 30 days off from drinking. So I decided I would take 30 days off from drinking, and I did it. I did it. And I got honest with two people. One was my hair cutter, who, I don't know, she had sharp scissors. She 12-stepped me beautifully. She was in the program. She's cutting my hair, talking about her experience. Strength and hope, you know, and I'm just sitting there, and out of my mouth, you know, came the words, I have a problem. She invited me to her home group, so that was one person, and the second one was my therapist. I actually got honest with my therapist, who happened to be an AA. And we had worked together for a couple years. I really, really trusted her, and I said, I'm in trouble. And at that point, my 30 days was up. My 30-day experiment was up. It was the day I was going to go start to drink again. But something, I don't know why. Why do we turn one way and not the other? No. Instead, I went to my first AA meeting. And I didn't know what the hell was going on in there. I know everyone was kind of looking at me because I had to raise my hand because I was first. A very kind woman bought me a big book. I'll never forget that. She put it in my hand. She said, "This is yours." And I got with my therapist, and I asked her to help me, and she said, "From this day on, I am your sponsor. I am not your therapist." And we switched relationships, and it went really well. I know that's probably not everybody's story. That wouldn't work for everybody. But for me, it was a godsend because I believed in her. I believed in her, and I did what she suggested. And I'm really a product of contemporary and traditional AA. Contemporary in that there's a meeting on every corner, right? And, like, most of us know people in AA, right? It's not like old days where it's like one meeting in Akron and one in New York, and, you know. And, like, they don't let you in the program until you go upstairs and get on your knees. You know, I don't know if I would have done. Well, they wouldn't even let me in. I was a woman, so they wouldn't even let me in for the first. Forget about it. And I really didn't go down far enough. I wasn't, like, in handcuffs yet in, like, the local dryout place. But, contemporary AA, in that you guys welcomed me. There's a meeting on every corner. I knew a bunch, and I had some acquaintances. But traditional AA, you know, right from the book, these steps, my sponsor got me working. We worked about a step a week. I didn't know there was any other way to do it. So, and I'm really glad I didn't know. There just wasn't any argument in me. There wasn't any fight, and I fight other things. I've got a fighter in me. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a fighter. I'm sure there's fighters out there. We all know fighters. But we just met. We met at this one place. We read the book. We did the step. We met next week, and, you know, they were like dominoes. The steps were like dominoes. They built on each other. It's like one falling over made the next fall over, and I began to. She taught me the legacies, so she had me draw the legacies in my book, and I totally drew them wrong, and to this day they're wrong in my book. But she taught me those, and she put the pin dot in the middle of the triangle. She just made a pen mark, and she said, "Stay in there, stay in there." She said that thing that they say. Did you ever drink in bars? And it's like, yes, I drank in bars. She said, "Did you sit on stools?" I'm like, yes, I sat on stools. "How many legs does a stool have?" She's like, "Three." So she did that thing, the three legacies. You know, you need all three of them. So she got me into the recovery legacy really fast, you know, one step a week, and things started to move. There's some sunlight started to come into my life. She got me into the service legacy really fast. I started making coffee. I got a home group. I started making coffee at that home group on Tuesdays. The unity legacy, I would go to meetings, but I didn't really make friends for a year. That happened really slowly. I had trouble talking to women. I was frightened. But, you know, I was doing the steps, and I was making coffee, and I belong. So that cemented me. It hooked me in. We got down on our knees on the third step. Again, Zen was very helpful because Zen has you on your knees a lot. There's like a lot of like atonement ceremonies where you go down on your knees a lot. And one of these Roshis would have like a little place on his head with a callus from like putting his head on the ground. So getting on your knees was okay for me. That wasn't a problem. So we got on our knees. We held hands. We did the third step prayer. She got me right into an inventory. She gave me a packet. The fifth step promises are really, really intense. I love them now. When I read them, I'm like, yes, you know, I'm reading them. But they did not happen for me that way. The power of this program, the power of the steps, really came in step nine. That's when I remember the day I stepped into my home group. I was two or three amends in. And I just came in, and I was just, my head was up, and my chest was out, and I felt I belong, you know. I'm a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I've got something to give. And as soon as I realized that, I was receiving. Something was flowing in to me. And those Nine Step Promises, we hear them so much, and it's kind of hard for me to make them fresh, but if I'm really honest about it, that's what happened. I mean, that's what started to happen to me. They started to flow in when I started to make my amends. And she worked really closely with me. I had one where she said, okay, let's just talk about this because you could go to jail because of I destroyed a bunch of property. So she's like, let's just get real on this one. Are you ready to go to jail? So I had and the book really walks us through that, like those decisions, like what I have to weigh. You know, who would suffer if I went to jail? And I didn't have kids, so that excuse is out. I'd already caused my parents enough misery; they didn't know what to do with me. So how about a little bit more? But in the end, and she didn't push, and she didn't suggest. That's that private prayer conversation I had to have. And at the end, I knew I have to make this. I have to make this. Didn't go to jail. I just owed a lot of money. And I'm still actually paying that off today with a payment plan. But they let me put it on a payment plan, so we're great. But it was those kinds of things that started to light my life up. The suicide thoughts went away. Not only was I not interested in drinking, I mean, that went away really quickly. Now, I am an alcoholic, and my body remembers. Even when my mind is right, my body remembers. I can catch a smell, and I will have a reaction, a physical reaction. My throat will start to water, my mouth will water, and that's just a nice little reminder of where I came from, how much I drank, what I drank, what it was like at the end. I guess my favorite step remains step 9. I know we lose a lot of people at 9. I know we lose people at like 4 and 9. That's where they tend to go. But I just love step 9. So many wonderful things happen for me. I only got one door in the face. I only got one kicked out of the office, like Bill says. And that was good too. It's kind of like a badge of honor. It's like I've been kicked out of the office. You know, at least I swept my side of the street. But there was one in particular. I promised Rusty I'd tell the story. I was sober, but I had a fake service animal. I had a dog, and I really wanted to fly with that dog. So I did not have any diagnosis except alcoholism, and I decided I'd get myself a diagnosis so I could fly with my dog. And I did. I lied to a doctor, and I got a certificate. I pretended to have panic attack disorder, and I got a certificate so I could fly with my dog. And I was sober, but somehow that, like, creeping conscience hadn't come into that area yet. And I was in a big book study group with some girls. I got invited into a big book study group that goes on to this day with 5 other women. That's a lifesaver. We get together, we make dinner, we study the big book. And I just happened to mention I was about to fly somewhere with my dog, you know. And this woman was like, how big's your dog again? And I was like, 30 pounds. And she was like, how are you flying with that dog in the cabin? And I was like, oh, I have a certificate. So it was a little sheepish, but, you know, it's my business, right? So anyway, right after the big book study, she's in my face. And she said, I signed a pledge about people like you. My pledge was I would confront people like you and make you stop because you're harming people with real disabilities. So we just got out of a big book study, right? So that's probably why I managed not to say anything. I managed not to say anything. I got home. I called my sponsor. I was furious. Of course, my business, blah, 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 blah. But after talking to my sponsor, after settling down a little bit, after sleeping on it, you know, the wake-up came. What am I doing? I am hurting people. I'm hurting people. There are real people who need their real animals, and I'm bringing, like, my mutt from, like, a Long Island shelter onto the plane. Like, I mean, she's well-behaved. Like, I trained her on escalators and stuff, and she's good. But she is not a service animal. And I went through TSA once before all this fakery started happening, and one of the, like, nice workers came up and, like, tried to help me, you know? And I was just like, oh, God, you know, what am I doing? So I woke up, and I was like, this has got to stop. This has got to stop. And I knew there was an amends there. I'm all about the ninth step, right? So I knew there was an amends there. So I was like, okay, what do I do? So there's this company in Atlanta, Canine Companions, and they train animals. And so I was like, all right, I'll give their local branch a call. Sorry. I called up the local branch, and no one answered. I left a message on their answering machine, and I was like, hey, you know those fakers who have fake animals? That's me. I'm going to leave you a small donation, and I'm so sorry. Here's my number in case you want to call. Figured I'd never hear from them. Well, an hour later, got a phone call from the woman who ran the local branch of Canine Companions, which happens to be a national organization. And she said that they were working on a little media piece, and I might be really good for it. So could somebody from a media outlet give me a call maybe and see if maybe I'd be a good fit? So you know, spiritual life is not a theory. So I said yes, and about an hour later, got a call from a guy from New York City who worked for CBS, and he interviewed me, and he thought I would be a really good fit for their story on fake service animals. So next week, you know when you get on a horse and there's no halter, so you just go where the horse goes? It's like what this amends was like. You just ride that amends, you know, you can't just, like, you don't get to say when the amends is over. You know? So a week later they flew a TV crew down and took me to a hotel room and filmed me. And I ended up on Good Morning America and 2020. With a stamp over my face that said, I lied. I think that if you care or you Google this at some point, I think I may still be in the top 10 if you Google fake service dog. Well, night came for it to show on 2020, and you know, I had gotten like makeup done, so I thought I was looking pretty good. So I sat down to watch it, and this was God's final laugh at me. There was a tornado warning that blotted out the whole segment. So I never got to see myself looking good with I lied over my face. Yeah. But, you know, after all the laughing was done, more power released from that and more integrity, you know. More being able to live in my own skin. It wasn't long into the steps that I realized that there is one who has all power. And I'd gotten glimpses of that when I was a kid. Once I was in the winter camping and I had an experience, but I think I was 18 or 20, 21. But, you know, and I remember that experience, but you know what I remember more? My first beer when I got back into town from the wilderness. So it's only from not drinking that God and I have a relationship. I love God. I pray now. It's a God of my understanding. He's with me. But God and I both know that as soon as I start drinking, that's my God. I treated alcohol. I worshipped alcohol. The word worship wasn't one that I would have used in any area of my life, but you can't deny that's what it was, the way I thought about it. I hugged it to me. There are pictures of me holding it like an infant, like drinks, you know, just here. I depended on it. I waited for it. I loved it. I argued with it. It was a worshipful experience, and I'm a person who has to worship, I realize. I'm not a temperate personality. I'm always going to want more. It's just more of what? You know, more of what? And there are all the spiritual traditions and religious traditions have this kind of language ready for me, you know, to drink of it and be thirsty for more. That sounds like it's talking about alcoholism, and it is, to drink of it and be thirsty of more, but it's talking about God now for me. To have had these experiences and to want more. This is the only safe more for me now. I can get a little distracted about other things. I have a job. I'm employable, you know. Yay! You know, my job or whatever. But there's only one safe more. The moment, and God is all over my life, was all over taking the steps. I took the 12th step with my sponsor. We were at a meeting. It was before a meeting. We knelt on the carpet, and we got up. She said, "Are you ready?" And I walked into the meeting. I said, "Yes." I walked into the meeting, and it was like this. It was like a football play. You know when, like, the quarterback goes back, and he just does not see what's over there? It's like this woman, I didn't even see her. She ran up to me, and she was like, "Will you be my sponsor?" This was 15 minutes after I'd completed the 12th step. And I looked at her, and I spent the next 5 minutes trying to argue her out of it. Like, I haven't been sober that long. You know, I don't think we would relate. Like, you would be my first, you know. But she just would not hear it. So we met. We started going through the book. She had some prior problems, and she had to go back to jail. So I lost touch with her. But I never looked back after that. I was taught very early, it's not going to be me that gets anybody sober. Nobody needs me as their sponsor, but I need a sponsor. And I don't need to sponsor any particular woman. I just need a sponsor. And they need a sponsor, probably, but that's not my business to tell them. So I started to offer myself for sponsorship, and that's just been, and it's just been incredible. I mean, it's been all over the map. I mean, to watch people come alive and to watch people go out, it's everybody's either a dire warning or a shining example. And either way, if I can just, I was just on my porch waiting for one of my sponsees the other day. She stood me up, and I had the book, and I was waiting, and I was breathing, and I was praying, and I just felt, I knew she wasn't going to come. I had that feeling, you know, she just wasn't going to come. And I just thought, I'm sober. I'm so grateful. I'm not standing people up anymore. I'm here. You know, here I am, God. I made room in my schedule for you and this woman. We were going to talk about you when we met. She's not here. That's okay. And then when I got her on the phone, it's just there's just that peace there in the conversation. And we talk about why she missed it. We talk about alcoholism. I try to point to what the mind is doing, the alcoholic mind. I'm not judging. I'm not offended. I'm sober. But let's look at the mind. What happened there? You know, she wants to get sober, she'll get sober. So I don't know. My life is unrecognizable. I try to put AA in the middle. I try to make AA like those big rocks in the river, and the river has to flow around them. You know, the rocks don't move. The AA commitments stay. They're the most important thing in my life. I'm a brat, and I'm selfish, so I totally fight them, and I get peevish about them. But the actions do not care why I take them. If I can just take them, the gift is on the other side of the action. After one of my first Macon experiences, maybe 4 years ago or 5 years ago, I was driving home. And, you know, I live in Atlanta, and the drive between Macon and Atlanta isn't like, it's not like Big Sur, you know, it's like billboards, and it's kind of flat, and it's not a magical drive, but but I was driving, and it was a spiritual experience. And it's because I was on the other side of the action, the other side of going to Macon, the other side of giving a weekend, you know, imperfectly. I'm like not the best trusted servant, like at all. I mean, I would be schooled up and down about the service manual, but, you know, at least I show up. But it was on the other side of the action, and that was the gift. You know, the God's availability was on the other side of that. So I someone said it in my home group once, just train your feet. Train your feet. Stop listening to this and, like, whatever. You know, we're so addicted to our feelings. It's like, I don't feel good today. I don't feel good. It's like, just the feet don't have feelings. All right, just do the action. Make the call, set up the meeting, go to the home group, and then the feelings changed. It's amazing, the feelings changed. I mean, wasn't I after quick change with my tequila? Yeah, I was. You know, it's not as quick now. Action steps aren't as quick as shots were. But this recovery is progressive, just like the disease was progressive. And I don't even know. I'm only 6 years in. I know the odds are against me. Because this is a killer. I know I only have today. That's why when I wake up, I just try to say, here I am. You know, I love you, here I am. Put AA into the middle of the day, and so far it's going real well. Thanks for having me.